Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Judiciary. Judiciary, we're not meeting tomorrow afternoon. I know that breaks all of your heart. The Senate President has allowed us another week to finish certain Senate bills, but would like us to move as many as we can today. So with that in mind, we have some bills we're going to move where we're just going to be presented the amendments for the first time. And if it were earlier in the session, we would have more time to consider them, but we need to concentrate next week and in the future on the House bills. So we'll commence with a work session on Senate Bill 405, and I understand we have 504, excuse me, and I understand that we have a consensus to a conceptual amendment, which is always pleasing to hear, and I'd invite Robert Neuberger and Tom Mortland forward, please. Robert, this is your first time in front of my committee this year.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, it is the first time. I've been tied down over in the other body, Judiciary Civil Committee. Representative Williams has been treating me as a puppy would a new ball and had me by the scruff of the neck and busy most of the session. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Neuberg. I'm an attorney in private practice from Portland. I generally represent injured people and the families who have lost a loved one because of the wrongdoing of someone else. With me today is Mr. Tom Mortland, and I'll let him further introduce himself and his work with insurance companies. We have been working and polishing the language to the Dash 3 amendments of Senate Bill 504. Chairman, if you would like, I can simply read you what the language we've come up with and then explain how I think it's going to work.
That would be very helpful.
And referencing line 24 of page 1, if you would strike the colon after the word if and insert the following. And then so I'll just go ahead and read the whole subsection with the new language. Subsection 1 of this section does not apply to actions to recover personal injury protection benefits or uninsured or uninsured motorist benefits if, and the new language is, comma, in writing, comma, not later than 6 months from the date proof of loss is filed with the insurer, colon. And then going over to the second page of the Dash 3 amendments, under subsection B at line 4, strike the word insurer, strike the word insured and replace it with the word insurer, and then also strike the words not agreed and replace them with the word consented.
The word what?
Consented. As in, no, I won't say it. I'll just leave those consented. Now, see if I can put all of this now in some context and what the meaning of it is. For many, many decades, I think dating back to the 1920s, the state has had a version of ORS 742.061, which provides that when someone who has insurance has a claim against their insurer, and the insurer has not paid the claim within 6 months after proof of loss, and then is forced to file a lawsuit, and is in one of the 1 to 3% of cases that actually goes to trial after it's been filed, that would be entitled, in addition to the damages recovered, an award of reasonable attorney's fees to be set by the court. The purpose of Senate Bill 504, as originally proposed to you, and the series of Dash amendments, was to make 742.061 not applicable to first-party claims, as claims by the insured party, as a party who paid the premiums, and a claim against their insurer in cases involving claims for personal injury protection, uninsured motorist, and underinsured motorist benefits. The concept that we have before you, realizing that this is a bill that was going to move, is this. And here's how it would work for PIP, UM, and UIM claims. It'd still be just like always. The insured suffers a loss, files a proof of claim or a notice of claim. And if it is one of those cases that isn't resolved short of litigation, the case goes into litigation. Generally, now there would be an exception for PIP, UM, and UIM claims if the insurer did the following. Within that six-month period in which a proof of claim was made, it did the following in writing. Agreed that there was no dispute as to coverage, and that for UM and UIM claims, that the only issue was going to be the liability of the uninsured or underinsured motorist and the amount of the damages to the injured party, and consented that it would use binding arbitration as alternative dispute resolution. So let me give you, an example. If I'm going too fast, let me know, Mr. Chairman. Let's say you have an uninsured motorist claim. Someone gets hit by a motorist who has run a stop sign and is not insured. The way it typically works is at some point the insurance company sends the insured a form, the proof of loss, it gets filled out, and there something happens, there's a negotiation, there's not a meeting of the mind, so a person goes to an attorney and a lawsuit is filed. At that, and the insurance company gets sued. The process server shows up at the door, the registered agent hands them the papers, and then they go to the adjuster. Now, at that point, the insurance company has an option. They can simply write a letter, no legal form required, and say, there's no dispute about coverage. The premiums were paid. It wasn't a stolen car. You didn't tell us you were using a car for business purposes, and you got hurt on the job. And so the only issues that are left is, liability for UM and UIM claim and damages. And we also, insurance companies, and we also consent to be bound by arbitration, use binding arbitration. Now it kicks back over to the insurer, the person who paid the premiums, and they can elect to stay in court, in circuit court, and have their case tried to a judge or a jury, but not get attorney's fees. Or they can go to binding arbitration. It's a carrot the whole way along, no stick, it's all carrot.
Okay.
The six-month provision protects the insurance companies even if no proof of loss is actually filed, because the six-month period in that situation would simply run from the date that the lawsuit was filed and ultimately then served. If the insurance company does not send the written notice within 6 months, and there are no extensions for it because there are not any extensions in the original statute, or disputes coverage, saying, well, we're going to dispute liability or damages, we don't even think you're covered. Or says we won't be bound by arbitration, we won't use binding arbitration, then the insured, the person who pays the premiums, gets to keep their case in court. If they are one of the 3% cases that goes to trial and they prevail and they beat the offer, because all those things have a lot of hurdles to go over, then the court is to award reasonable attorney's fees. Now, there are some other exceptions that a lot of other hurdles I won't talk to. One has to go over and actually get attorney's fees under that historical statute. But that's how it would work.
I understand. Ms. Morton. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Morton. I'm employed by North Pacific Insurance Company as a claims manager and also in a legal capacity as an attorney. I'm pleased to represent to the committee that Mr. Neuberger has accurately indicated the substance of the change that we've agreed upon. I was here before this committee several days ago describing to you a problem that I, as a representative of the insurance industry, perceived in the way that case law had developed and that the way the statute was being applied in practice. And again, I'm pleased to indicate that I believe we've arrived at a solution that represents a consensus between both of the general sides or participants, if you will, in the litigation and claims process. I'm pleased to report that. I'd like to conclude simply by thanking Mr. Neuberger for his efforts in reaching what I think is a very good solution to this problem. Thank you.
Thank you both. Questions?
committee, because this is considered a conceptual amendment, we'll have to bring it back. I'm sure the Senate President will allow me to do that. So, Ann, why don't we schedule it for Tuesday?
Are you putting on the floor conceptual amendment?
No, I'm getting in trouble.
This one's had too much. Could you leave your handwritten notes just to make sure that we have it accurately?
And before you drop the gavel, Mr. Chairman, if I could just indulge you in a clinic for one more thing. Honesty compels me to say this was all Mick Alexander's ideas. He couldn't be here today.
So you're pitch hitting for Mick?
I am.
I thought maybe they divided the House and the Senate, that they thought you would work better on the House side and that Mick would take responsibility for my committee.
Mr. Chairman, the Oregon Car Wars Association, based on my track record, the last few sessions has concluded that I don't work well anywhere.
And we'll bring it back on Tuesday with the team. All right, I think we will next go to... Okay. Oh, all right. We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 915. We have one witness, and it's primarily here to discuss the fiscal. This has already been heard by another committee, Pete Shepard.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. In light of the committee's agenda, I'll try to be very brief and familiarize the committee with the gist of this proposal, which, as the chair correctly reported previously, was considered and passed with a due pass recommendation by Senator Nelson's committee. The committee should have the fiscal impact statement, which is de minimis. The gist of this bill deals with the problem that all of us have experienced of receiving unwanted telephone solicitations in our residences. Oregon does have a statutory scheme that's intended to reduce the incidence of unwanted commercial solicitation calls to our residences. However, that scheme is not working well, and we think we've come up with a reasonably creative and appropriate and inexpensive answer that will improve the situation. And the basic problem is that current law allows but does not require a telephone directory company to offer its customers the opportunity to pay a monthly fee to have their name listed in that directory as a do not call listing, known popularly as the black dot law, because that's usually how it shows up in the directory. The trouble for consumers is that those lists are sometimes difficult for businesses to get, and the other trouble for consumers is that the directory may only be published once a year, in which case the consumer may pay for a service that isn't effective for as much as 11 months. The problem for businesses that want to use the legitimate tool of telephone solicitation is, again, that they may not be able to get access to that list, or if they do get access to the list, it may not be timely, and thus they may inadvertently violate the existing statutes that prohibit contacting a consumer who's paid for that service. So the gist of this idea is simply to provide that the Department of Justice will enter into a contract with a non-governmental third party that will maintain a central list of consumers who don't wish to be contacted by telephone solicitors, and then the statutes would be changed so that it would become a violation of law to contact the consumer whose name was on that list rather than making it a violation of law to contact a consumer whose name is in the directory. We worked this out in conjunction with representatives of the telecommunications industry. We think we've ironed out most of the problems that any folks there might have with the bill. I will tell the committee, in the spirit of candor, that the only potential objection that I understand to remain to the concept is that the position of administrator of this list is likely to be a fairly attractive position from an economic standpoint. And the way this is drafted, not everybody would qualify to become the administrator of that list. And as a consequence, there are some who may wish to qualify as the administrator who wouldn't necessarily be eligible as an administrator. But there's no objection, so far as I'm aware, to the basic concept of a contract administrator for this list. And that's all I have for the committee.
And there's a $10 fee to the consumer for this?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Under current practice, it's my understanding that directory publishers who offer this service now usually charge 50 cents a month. So we'd be talking about a difference of $4. This approach has been taken in two other states, Florida and Georgia. The initial registration fee in Florida, which has the longer running of the two programs, is $10. And renewal fees are $5.
And how would that be billed and collected?
Mr. Chair, the consumer, in order to place their name on this list, would contact the contract administrator and pay the fee at the time they either initially registered or paid their renewal. I should say also, Mr. Chair, that $10 is the maximum fee. We would anticipate doing a request for proposals for the contract, and one of the things we would certainly look at is whether competing persons for this contract were able to offer that service to consumers for less than $10 annually.
My experience with the black dot, having a black dot by our name in the phone book, initially it worked, but as the years progressed, it doesn't work anymore.
Mr. Chair, I think you've experienced the very problem that this statute suffers from, and that is that in 1989, when the black dot statute was adopted, perhaps it was correct that the primary source of commercial solicitation lists was the telephone directory. Today, however, that's not the case. There are a zillion different places where companies can obtain lists, and those lists often do not contain the black dot listing because they aren't derivative of the directory listing.
Do those solicitors then come through the your department then? Or how does everything, if they didn't do that, what's the sanction against them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, let's say I was a company selling windshield repair services, and I wanted to use telephone solicitations as part of my marketing tool. Under this statute, I would be required to contact the third-party administrator and obtain the list from the third-party administrator and then screen my own solicitation list against that list. And the sanction for failing to do that would be the same as it is under current law for violating the present black dot statute, and that is a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. As a practical matter, the Department of Justice reserves that remedy for repeat violators who've previously been warned, and I wouldn't expect that to change in the future. The statute also does provide and would continue to provide potentially for a private cause of action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but that requires a consumer to show that they suffered an ascertainable loss before they could bring an action.
And it would under the unfair trade practices, that there's also an individual right, too, as I recall.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The condition, as I say, on the consumer demonstrating an ascertainable loss, which in some of these cases the consumer would not. As
the loss of sleep. I hope this applies to financial planners and stockbrokers.
Mr. Chair, they wouldn't be exempted.
So, Nelson, did your committee have any issues as it worked the bill? All right, we're on fast five. Any questions, Mr. Shepard? If not, we'll close the public hearing, open the work session on Senate Bill 915. Senator Nelson.
Will you pass recommendation?
Thank you. Senator Nelson moves Senate Bill 915 as amended. Before we do pass, discussion, objection, so on. Senator Nelson, would you carry? Thank you. All right, we will now go to genetic privacy, and we'll have a work session on Senate Bill 937. Committee, the work group has come to a satisfactory resolution and I'll invite them up to explain the amendments, and then Scott Gallant from the Oregon Medical Association has some concerns, and we've each received a copy of his letter. What I'm going to do is have him discuss that with us, and then give the sponsors an opportunity to respond to that. But Jim, who would you like to have come up and explain the amendments to? That would be fine. What can I ask you to do? Okay. These are only the draft two amendments, but I can assure you they're probably the 30th draft of the draft two amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and I'm distributing to you another copy of a document that was distributed the last time that we were before this committee, entitled Consensus Elements of Genetic Privacy. And at that last meeting, we were happy to report that Pharma, Kaiser, OHSU, and OGPAC had managed to come to a rather comprehensive agreement on what we entitled Consensus Elements of Genetic Privacy. And perhaps if I can just go over those with you briefly again to remind the committee of where we were when we began the actual process of translating those into statutory language. The consensus item number one was we agreed that the property rights approach to protection of genetic privacy could be replaced with direct protection of genetic privacy. And from our perspective, that had two beneficial effects. One, in terms of the business climate for biotech investment in the state of Oregon, which was a key priority of the Portland Development Commission, as well as the Oregon Biosciences Association. But second, and equally important, it dealt with the problem that the property concept lent itself to some potential for abuse, in as much as property is an alienable right as opposed to an inalienable right. And we had documentation before the committee indicating that there was a potential that you could actually sell and traffic in your genetic rights, which we felt was something that that if we could do achieve the policy objectives of privacy protection by another means, we should do that for the two reasons of economic development, but also enhancing the quality and the durability of the privacy protection. Consensus item number two was the four of us were able to agree that the enforcement mechanism for giving teeth to genetic privacy protection should be the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And Ted Falk with OGPAC is going to distribute to you, I think, today a text of an excellent monograph that he has prepared, which goes through these changes and really documents, I think, how much very efficacious this remedy is likely to be in terms of potential violations. Consensus item number three was an agreement that the federal common rule standard governing biomedical research, which is codified in the Code of Federal Regulations and also known as the Federal Policy for the Protection of Human Subjects, is appropriate to govern the use and retention of genetic information for non-anonymous research for which informed consent has been obtained regardless of the source of funding, so that even if it were purely private research, that would apply. In reality, most of the research, 99% of the research that our industry does is already subject to that, because it is applicable if the research is going to be used in an FDA application for a new drug application, et cetera, even if the source of funding is private. So we were happy to agree to that. Consensus item number four, the four of us were able to agree that anonymous research should be expanded to include information that has been coded or encrypted to protect the identity of the individual, as well as information that is truly anonymous as defined in the current statute. And this was very important because In essence, research that is done both in the academic setting and in the research laboratories of the industry is encrypted to protect the language of the identity of the individual, but it is almost without exception not, quote, truly anonymous. And to shut down that kind of research would pose not only a commercial hazard, but more important, a risk to ongoing research in epidemiology, in outcomes, and other areas that are so terribly important to the public health.
Could you give us an example of that? An example of why this would be needed and why it's helpful.
Perhaps I could turn that question over to Jim Mattis. Would you, Jim, why coded research encrypted data is important in addition to, quote, truly anonymous research?
The coded material in terms of tissue banks that are at Oregon Health Science University, Kaiser, and elsewhere, and which do work under the common rule or the Federal Protection for Human Subjects, do currently work with a form of coded or encrypted in order to seek to maintain confidentiality. Those standards as to what to the specifics of what those are, while this group has searched to find them, they don't exist beyond references to that. One of the things that Jim Gardner has identified that he has a particular interest in is working over the interim with other groups, and OHSU would enjoy doing that, to come up with as good a standard relative to encryption as we possibly could.
But to answer your question in a short sense, this is the essence of the kind of biomedical research that's going on right now in Oregon and in every other state. The category of, quote, truly anonymous research, where you can't, there is no theoretical possibility of doing a linkage, is essentially a null set. That's not what we do or what academic health research centers do. So it's, and it's really the reason, in large part, we're here before you with this legislation.
And encrypted and coded, I noticed both are used, and they have a specific meaning.
Yes.
Encryption is a type of coding, but it's a specific type of coding. And
encryption is essentially a technique for rendering non-identifiable genetic information without the use of an encryption key. It's like what the National Security Agency does when it sends a piece of information to an embassy overseas, or it's a way of making it indecipherable without the key. So that's Jim Mattis is absolutely correct. We have searched and found much to our, I guess, surprise in part, that national encryption standards really don't exist. And so once more, Oregon is on the cutting edge here, and we hope that working with OGPAC and OHSU, we'll be able to have some excellent debate and discussion and essentially self-education over the interim on this very interesting and important issue of encryption standards.
Well, I hope that someone on the committee takes a real interest in this. So when I get phone calls and I can speak on encryption standards, I can refer to one of you.
What's the other clip?
Oh, yes. And Mr. Chair, if I might continue, and then I consensus item 5, the four of us were able to agree that for purposes of medical diagnosis, the designated representative or closest surviving blood relative, if there is no designated representative of a deceased individual, should be allowed to permit the individual's identifiable DNA sample to be made available for genetic testing. And this is essentially to allow blood relatives to try to figure out, you know, what sorts of risks might be out there for them. Those were the principles. We spent a lot of time coming to a consensus on these, very carefully crafting the wording, and then came the real challenge, which was to translate these principles into statutory language. We worked long and hard at this, and I want to commend my colleagues at the table, and I think we all owe each other a good stiff drink when this is all over, because it was a very interesting, very laborious, very technologically challenging process. We are, as Bruce Bishop said in his letter of endorsement on behalf of Kaiser, we are really at the cutting edge of the next technology revolution. There are many who say just as the 20th century was the century of information technology, the 21st century will be the century of biology, and we're right at the forefront of trying to cope with all of the challenges that present. We work.
Yep.
Jimmy, you're going to want to drink too because we have to listen to stuff. Thank you.
And I'm almost done, Mr. Chair. We worked long and hard, and we tried to map this language as closely as possible onto the consensus principles. I think, as you will hear from the OMA, there are still some items of controversy. This is the best, the very best, the four groups here could do in terms of achieving the objective of improving genetic privacy protection by moving from property to direct protection of privacy, giving it enforcement teeth, improving the business climate for biotech investment, and also keeping Oregon at the forefront of dealing with the challenge of this new technological revolution.
Thank you. Yeah.
Is this information transferred via the Internet, or how is it? How is it stored? Is it within the house?
It's within house, within institutions, within research laboratories, either within our companies or within OHSU. And it's, to my knowledge, it has never been on the Internet. Interestingly enough, the results of and Brad, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but results of the Human Genome Project will be in the public domain. Which is the federally funded project to sequence the entire human genome, that will be in the public domain and open to all. But that's sort of the generic code that will be open to all researchers and should be.
Ms. Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ted Falk, and I'm one of the members of the Oregon Genetic Privacy Advisory Committee and one of the original authors of this bill back in 1994 for the 95 session. My main purpose in testifying is just to deliver to you what Jim has referred to as my monograph. I think monograph is the lobbyist signal for you don't have to read it. I'm not going to read it. I only wanted to call your attention to a couple of points. The first five headings in my monograph, as Jim called it, track the five consensus principles. And so this gives you kind of a little bit below the surface, the legal analysis under the 5 points. And then the sixth and seventh headings were kind of some technical amendments that were put into the bill that didn't really relate to any controversial item, but just kind of explains it to you. I wanted to call your attention to the last couple of pages, which I've stapled onto this an article that appeared in yesterday's New York Times about how Duke University had its federal funding for all of their medical research suspended because of defects in their IRB process. And the reason that's interesting is that in this piece of legislation, we are relying very heavily at a number of points on the integrity of the federal common rule and on the fact that institutional review boards or IRBs actually do their job. And it's somewhat encouraging, although maybe going overboard, but certainly encouraging to hear that the federal government is taking the common rule very seriously. The other thing that I wanted to underline, just as Jim Gardner and Jim Mattis have stated to you, I think that it's very important that the dialogue over adequate coding and encryption standards continue after the legislative session ends, because there's only so far we were able to get in terms of drafting legislative language. There still is a need here for standards that the provider community would follow, standards that the industry would follow, and because we didn't find those standards anywhere, we ought to create a task force of a voluntary group here in Oregon to address that issue, and then a number of other issues that have come up in the dialogue over this bill. That's all I have for today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be back and to tell you that I think we're
we're very close with a document that we can all live with. And I'd like to bring forth just two issues today that I think are important that we need to factor into to the way things unfold from here. You know, at the beginning of this, at the beginning of the legislative session, we really had two issues before us. Those two issues related to the property provision and certain restrictions that that created. And the second issue was the issue relating to identifiable tissue samples and using those for medical or biotechnological research. I think with that said, it's important to point out that I think that the law had a very carefully crafted intent. And as I said the last couple weeks ago when I was here, that was really to deal with patients undergoing medical testing and protecting those individuals from misuses of their information and ultimately discrimination based on that. And I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that since this law has been enacted in 95, that although I'm on the front line of this and providing this information daily to hundreds of Oregonians, I'm not aware of anybody that's experienced discrimination since that time. And really my intent has always been, and my involvement in this process has been to preserve that and make sure that whatever amendments we make to this law, which we're going to have to make more, I'm sure, in the future, are in keeping with what the original intent was. I think we also need to point out, though, that although the intent and the way this law has unfolded has been very good, that in fact we've created a bit of a wrinkle, and that wrinkle is for using coded or encrypted specimens for legitimate medical research. And what I'd like to do today is address 937-2 and two things that I think it brings up that still potentially limit the original intent of the law. Now, the first is that this compromise bill, or 937-2, would allow laboratories performing genetic testing for medically indicated purposes to not only generate a genetic test result for the medical test being ordered by the patient's physician, but it would also allow the laboratory to generate a genetic profile on the tested individual for any disease or diseases for which the laboratory desired to test that person. And these additional tests could be performed without the patient's consent. And in fact, could be, especially in the event that those were called epidemiological or outcome-based studies. And those two terms bother me because I don't really understand what those mean. To me, it's a very broad categorization of types of research that happens in medicine that concerns me. And the results of these investigations would be able to be, via encryption or encoding, would be able to be linked back to the patient. So, and currently, that practice is forbidden under the current law, and unless that testing is performed anonymously. And I'd like to point out for the record that such anonymous testing is essential for clinical diagnostic testing laboratories. And I think that this practice should be allowable. And I would really like to see, I think that the term anonymous is a fairly intuitive concept, meaning that the results cannot be linked back to the patient. And I'd like to see that remain in this, if possible. I clearly understand, and I mean clearly understand, the stated objectives of the research community in wanting to perform investigations on patient specimens for reasons that go beyond that which the patient has given their informed consent. And I supported the language contained in SB 1008, which imposed what I believe to be reasonable sets of restrictions on this type of research. But in 937-2, I'm concerned that it goes a bit too far and that the restrictions are a bit too broad or a bit too vague, I might say. And I continue to believe, though, that language can easily be crafted that would provide pharma, the research community, with the desired outcome while maintaining patient privacy and confidentiality. And it's really my hope that we will be able to continue to work on getting some clear wording for this. I do believe that if this isn't clarified, that we really risk eroding confidence in the public when they seek medical testing for diagnostic purposes. And I must say that in the past, since I was able to testify a couple weeks ago, I've been able to address a class of 200 senior nurses at OHSU and a group of senior physicians at OHSU And both groups agreed that, in fact, informed consent means that you do what the patient consents to. And if you go beyond that, one needs to be very, very careful in terms of making sure that that information cannot ever get back to the patient. And all I ask is that we just tighten this up to make sure that that loop is closed, and that cannot happen. The second issue, though, is one that it really gets back to the property amendment and or the property provision in the current law. And it's one that by changing it to the Fair Trade Practices Act, which I endorse and I think is a good idea, it still creates one, it leaves out one thing that is inherent in the current law. And what this really amounts to is that the current law provides a protection for blood relatives of the patient that was tested. Now, in genetics, you have to realize that if a genetic test is performed on a patient, that in fact that result has bearing on the entire family. And so even if a person that has not been genetically tested, a person could easily be discriminated against. And the law, the current law, protects the person from that. And a great example of this, to bring that point home, is about a week ago we diagnosed a child in the neonatal intensive care unit at OHSU that had a disease called congenital myotonic dystrophy. A very terrible disease. The child is born without any kind of muscle tone, serious respiratory difficulties, and unlikely to live. By diagnosing that child with DNA with that diagnosis, we also diagnosed the mother, who had never undergone genetic testing or even a clinical examination, and we were able to diagnose not only the child but the mother at the same time and say she had myotonic dystrophy. By doing that, I mean, if this law was enacted as is, I'm afraid that that mother would not have protection, and I think she should. And so I think whatever we do with the law, I think, again, this is a very easy change in a non-lawyer's viewpoint in terms of the wording that can be put into this to give that protection. So in conclusion, I think that the parties have worked very hard and very diligently to come up with a compromise. And I think that everybody has compromised, including OPAC and Pharma and OHSU and everybody, in terms of coming to something that really meets everybody's needs. And really what I'd like to say, though, is that I sincerely believe, though, that this, we really need to think about these two other provisions, and we need to somehow incorporate those at some stage in the legislative process into 937. And I guess I'll just end by giving you what I think is a way to possibly look at this, is that ask you a question that possibly will help you in thinking this through. If one was able to read your DNA and really think of this as your book of life and be able to predict your past, present, and future medical well-being, the question would be, would you want to read that book? And I think all of you, it would take a great deal of deliberation for you to think about if you wanted that read or not. The real question that I'm posing here, very simply stated, is, do you want me to be able to write that book and then read that book without your consent? And I think that's the issue, is that we really want to be careful to make sure that if anything happens without the consent of the patient, it's done without the patient being able to know those results ever. And so I sincerely believe that we've nearly reached a satisfactory compromise. And in the process, I think we will have clearly improved Oregon's pioneering genetic privacy law. I really ask your indulgence and support in allowing and assisting OPAC, OHSU, Pharma, and Kaiser in making these couple of fundamental amendments to 937-2. Thank you.
Doctor, if I understand your testimony, on the second point, although you're complimentary towards the dash 2, you're saying that you're still concerned because blood relatives don't have access to damages. Is that correct? In other words, you'd want the unfair trade practices portion of it also to apply to relatives if the potential person's genetics were disclosed?
That's correct. I think it's in Section 6 of 937-2. It would be easy to incorporate wording, in my view, that would easily cover that.
And then your first point, to me, is the more difficult one. I don't know what form doctors use for releasing now to get genetic testing, but it sounds like some releases are specific to a test rather than just the generic release form. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The standard of the industry in terms of the practice of genetics is very precise language for informed consent. It differs tremendously from what goes on in medical, in standard medical care. So the practice guidelines handed down by the American College of Medical Genetics, which is the governing body that really gives everybody their board certification in this area, really says that one has to be very concise about what test it is being ordered, what the risks are of having that test, what the benefits are, what the risks to family members are, and so on. And so the real problem here is it goes a step beyond that physician-patient relationship in terms of what they feel it's being consented for.
Under those standards, though, couldn't you add an option allowing the patient to say, you have my permission to use this test for other purposes?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's one way to do this, yes.
Okay. But you could do that as a practice now, correct?
I believe this could be done at the practice level, okay. Yes.
And do you want to change testimony, though, that there's a reluctance in your profession to do that?
Well, I guess the problem might be that testing is not done in Oregon. So it would be samples that would be being sent elsewhere. And really the question would be the assurance that the patient would have that if samples were sent wherever, that in fact they would have that assurance. That what they consented to was done, or if they opened the door for this sample to be used for any purpose, that could be done also. And I firmly believe a lot of patients would in fact give that consent. I do believe that. But also, there are many patients who would be reluctant to.
Well,
it's like the person asking for the consent wouldn't necessarily be the person who's going to use the DNA, would they be, necessarily?
That's correct.
So here you got someone who's not going to use it necessarily, asking for consent to use this ultimate privacy as a part, on the part of an individual, right?
Yes.
Also, where they ask them, I mean, where do you want to get down to it? You ask them right after you've taken care of the patient, brought them to an office, operating room, I can see where doctors would be scared to death to ask this. They're there to take care of the patient, not to get a bunch of things out of their body, which then they'll go take and use for research unless it's to bring back analysis of what's wrong with them. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Senator Courtney. What commonly happens is that with genetic testing, the physician does have to get the consent of the patient. That can be done verbally. It can be done by forms that were generated by the Oregon Health Division. It can be done by genetic counselors using forms that look very similar to the Oregon Health Division forms, many ways in which it's done. But it is at the level of the physician-patient relationship that consent is given. And I think that's the concern, is that does this then possibly violate that physician-patient relationship and the consent that they've received?
Is there anything else? Well, I guess surgeries and things all require consent. Just going getting your blood drawn or a urine sample doesn't require consent, correct? Stuff like that, I mean, right?
I can't speak to that. Mr. Mattis would like to speak to that. I mean, for some procedures, they're clearly for surgery, there are surgical consent forms. For others, there, I don't believe there are.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions for Dr. Popovich? Good afternoon.
Afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Mattis, for the record, I'm counsel with the Oregon Health Sciences University. I would like to say that Senate Bill 937-2 does meet the Health Sciences University's needs. We think it does so without diminishing confidentiality constraints and, in fact, strengthening privacy provisions. It allows valuable resources for scientific research contained in tissue banks to be available for the exercise of the scientific method in searching for answers and tools to improve human health, so long as its institutional review board, and we have one, has approved the research with due deference paid to the adequacy of keeping private, confidential, identifiable information secure and not available to researchers or others. And that includes researchers. And that's the way we would operate. I believe, as it must be apparent to you, that while we have achieved, and for the record, Bruce Bishop was one of the members of the drafting committee and he couldn't be here with us, consensus on the language that you had before you to meet the five principles that we did agree to. But as you can probably also see, it's a challenge to replace property with more specific provisions. Some of which even one member of the Oregon Genetic Privacy Advisory Committee has just laid out for you. I think, in fact, the reason for that is that property itself has so many different meanings to it. Included within it is the concept of being able to buy or sell that particular piece of property. And if that's done very early on, you certainly have the potential of undercutting a lot of the privacy confidentiality requirements that really goes at the heart of what this statute began as and continues to try to maintain. And I suspect, given the evolving science as well as just human nature, that there'll be continued tweaking on that issue for sessions to come. This won't be the last time you've heard of it. I would like to commend to you Ted Falk's analysis. I think he does an excellent job of showing, if this bill were to go forward, how it does change and what it seeks to do and what it does not seek to do. I would also like to point out to you that there have been other parties that have been interested in this legislation that have not been part of the drafting group. I would like to tell you that to the extent possible, we have earnestly tried to address their concerns as well. I'm thinking of the American Liberties Union. I'm thinking of the Oregon Medical Association. They have continued to have concerns about encryption and standards that relate to that. As Mr. Gardner has pointed out and others, we don't have adequate standards currently that we can reference to on that. That's a work that needs to be continually looked at and brought up to speed. They independently, that is the Oregon Medical Association, independently of this group and Ted's efforts, suggested the use of the Unfair Trade Practices Act as a way to put teeth in the privacy issues, confidentiality concerns that has been folded in to this bill. Not everything that everyone would like is here, and there probably isn't any way to achieve that. I would also, for the record, identify that on page 12, lines 10 and 11, the term identifiable is used in a piece of the statute that actually is in the insurance code. Those terms at some point should be deleted as it's used there, because those were defined terms of art in Senate Bill 10008, and that piece got picked up, but that nomenclature of taking that term out did not. And that's a piece that the OMA has pointed out, and I think we agree with that. I think we tried to do what the chair asked us to do, and within the constraints of the abilities to reach something that would work for the parties at the table, and we hopefully for others. We think 937 is an excellent bill.
Thank you. I think I'll do now is invite Scott Gallant up and allow him to make his comments, and then I think, Jim, you're going to be the one that will respond to those. Is that correct?
And Mr. Matta.
And Matt, Mr. Matta, okay.
Chair, if he's walking up here. For what it's worth, I think there's two issues, the issue of privacy and the issue of consent. And to a certain extent, I think we're commingling them. And I think those are two very distinct and separate issues when you're dealing with this kind of stuff. And I mean that.
Right, and you can give consent, but you still want to shut that.
Well, no, the influences that are brought upon a person to give consent, that should concern us as much as the privacy aspects of it. Simply because they're kept private, you know, medical testing on people, and sometimes what was done to get people to go along with certain medical testings, and you know those kinds of horror stories. There's that issue. And then there's the issue, of course, of how private it is. So I do think there is a major distinction between those two issues. And really, when we talk about consent, we've heard no testimony on what kind of influences or how you get them to consent or what the atmosphere, the elements that are in turn you put the form before the person. That's what I was trying to get to with Dr. Popovich, is to just the setting where you put the form before the person, their medical state of mind. I mean, you know, it's undue influence type of thing. That's the only reason I was trying to get Dr. Popovich to come out and try to create the setting for us where these consent forms are signed and how they're presented to a person. Anyway, we have another witness, so I won't go any further.
Scott.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm representing the Oregon Medical Association. Let me say first that I appreciate the willingness of you, Mr. Chairman, and your staff, who I think has done a wonderful job on this as well, of at least enabling the Oregon Medical Association to get its comments before the committee on a number of occasions. I think all of you have received, as we've gone through this process, commentary raising issues that we think are very serious for everyone, each individual, each patient who may or may not be involved in medical research. And the Medical Association does believe that it's important that we can appropriately have medical genetic research occurring at OHSU and elsewhere for the benefit of everyone. It has been somewhat difficult as a participant, maybe at arm's length, as this has been developed and processed by the specific working group, but the information has been shared with us, and again, I appreciate the proponent's willingness to do that, enabling us to make our comments. Our latest correspondence to all of you, and I believe you have all received it, is that you'll see that in the new -2 amendments on page 2, that the definition of genetic test has been changed to include the identity of an individual. And we have suggested on page 2 of our correspondence a suggested definition of non-identifiable research which tries to address that. We still believe that this would, in fact, enable those who are doing this research to identify individuals and that is without their consent, which is, in fact, a concern to us. While I'm not sure that I would necessarily choose my counsel's particular words, we do say that there are so many loopholes in this legislation regarding when seemingly private information may be used and disclosed that the concept of privacy becomes meaningless, and that continues to be our fundamental problem with the way the legislation currently reads. And, you know, in regard to the process of gaining informed consent and the applicability of the common rule, there are, in fact, under federal regulation, and I'll be happy to give this to the committee staff, a number of exceptions for that. Informed consent of individuals. For example, informed consent cannot be obtained from the subject because of an inability to communicate with or obtain legally effective consent from the subject. Time is not sufficient to obtain consent from the subject's legal representative. The informed consent shall be deemed feasible unless the investigator and the physician who is not otherwise participating in a clinical investigation certifying writing all of the following, and the list goes on for quite some time. We're merely trying to get to the fundamental issue that if you have a patient give specific informed consent for the testing and use of this that is for that specific purpose, one, and two, that is not used for subsequent purposes of which the individual really does not know that it's being used for further research. Our correspondence to you also addresses section, what is now the new Section 6, or section, more importantly, I believe, Section 7, where the language of the proposal says that an encryption or coding system used to protect the identity of the individual must comply with the procedures required of the federal law if that policy is applicable to the research using the system or otherwise be reasonably designed to protect the privacy of individuals who are subjects of the research. We believe that that is exceedingly loose language. That is essentially be determined by both institutional research entities, OHSU being one or others, and private research endeavors that are not necessarily connected to medical research institution, and should be in fact reviewed for consideration for tightening up. We would agree that further in that section that subsections regarding research constitutes epidemiological or outcomes research is exceedingly broad. Again, there ought to be some specificity to what kind of research that is so that it's in the law. Again, I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to try to convey some of our concerns in this, what we believe to be a very important and serious matter for everyone.
Thank you. Questions for Scott? Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Gardner again for Pharma. I think you have gotten a sense in this brief hearing of the complexity and challenge that your drafting committee faced in dealing with this these really myriad of cutting edge issues. And I would say to you that I would be the first to acknowledge that we are engaged in a delicate and difficult balancing exercise, and the status quo that we have now is, I think, by all all who are involved in this process would concede that that has some very major flaws, and some of them relate, I think, to some issues that Senator Courtney raised in terms of the issue of what kinds of pressures or what kind of settings exist when an informed consent is acquired or other methods are used to get what amounts to consent. And I would remind the committee of the document that we distributed at the very first hearing called Property Donation. And this was under the existing law. One is forced into a situation of essentially requiring the patient to turn over, in effect, to alienate their property interest, which is their genetic right, and once it's gone, it's gone. And as some dramatist once said, you're truly then at the mercy of the kindness of strangers. That's an artifact. That's a result of the fact that this is, under existing law, an alienable right, and there's every temptation in the world to comply with the law to try to get that transfer made. I would suggest to you that the structure that we have crafted into 937-2 dramatically reduces the incentive to overreach in that particular setting, because it provides that that the privacy right essentially is
an inalienable right. It can be waived. It can be. It has certain provisions allowing non-identifiable research, but it never can be sold. And that's a very important step forward, I think. So I would think that would be one thing that you might want to think about in terms of the balance of interests and rights that we're dealing with here. The other overarching theme is that that we are, in addition to the privacy interest, which is terribly important and which we think we have enhanced the protection of, there's also a public health interest here. The age of genetics has great promise in terms of treatment, but it also faces great challenges in terms of pathogens, viruses and bacteria that are multi-drug resistant, and we're fighting a battle for public health, and we need the tools to do that. The language that that Scott has suggested to you would essentially, in terms of the anonymous research provision, would keep the law the way it is now with regard to that. And what that really means is it would shut down the kinds of research that are going on right now under encryption standards at both OHSU and within the pharmaceutical industry in the areas of epidemiological research and outcomes research. And I'll just spend a minute saying what those are, because there was some discussion about how specific they are. Epidemiological research is research aimed at finding what are patterns of infection, patterns of spread of perhaps disease resist or drug resistant organisms, new strains of polio, new strains of tuberculosis, which are now cropping up, unfortunately, even in the United States. And it's very important to be able to track those and research those. Outcomes research is aimed at refining the indications for a particular drug to eliminate side effects, to figure out if there are particular groups that are more sensitive to it than others, and to essentially refine the usage prescriptions, the usage indications for new pharmaceuticals, so to make those a more effective tool. The issue of encryption standards is a challenging one. I would be the first one to admit that, and I think that that will be task one for us over the interim, to continue to work on that and pioneer, probably, because we'll have to, because they simply don't exist nationally, but that's something we're pledged to work on. The other thing that we are pledged to work on, which I think is perhaps as much as of importance as the language itself, is an educational campaign with particularly the smaller biotech companies in Oregon, so that they become aware of what these provisions are, they become aware of best practices standards, and they become aware of the provisions governing and creating these new remedies under the unlawful trade practices and enhancing privacy protection.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I did have a copy of Vionnet's letter dated with today's date that I got shortly before this work session. I guess I would point out two or three things here, if I might. In Section 1, they do note that the definition of genetic characteristic has been eliminated. We worked with geneticists and others come up with what we think is the best definition that can be provided in that, and in the process did away with one term that was defined in the current law and did away with the subjective standard that is in the current law. The suggestion on the second page of redefining non-identifiable research would do nothing in terms of changing the present law. You may as well stay with anonymous research as it is currently defined. Section 2, I suspect, is an area where it's the pivotal point. Do you stay with property and the somewhat amorphous and undefined, although well-defined in terms of common law, approaches to what you can do with property, or do you move to a different platform that seeks to provide privacy and confidentiality? In item number 3, There's a reference to a suggestion that perhaps Section 5 is redundant and can be taken out. I would point out to you that the current law that is referenced to there, 6597201E, only relates to genetic information. The new Section 5 relates to the DNA sample and the rights of blood relatives to have that retested. Relative to item 4, it is my understanding that currently surgical and medical providers, at least that are associated with Oregon Health and Sciences University, or in one fashion or another, do have consent forms in which research is consented to be allowed to be conducted. And finally, Mr. Chairman, if you want to labor this on further, someone, I think maybe it was you, asked for a good solid example of an outcomes research. We have a former member of our IRB, Dick Jones, with us here, who leaned over and told me he could tell you one that relates to cancer if you're so interested.
Would the committee be interested in hearing that?
Yes.
If you could, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Jones. I've been on the faculty of the medical school for 35 years, former chair of the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, served as acting president of the university for 14 months. I have a medical degree, have not practiced medicine, have a PhD, and been involved in research. As Jim Mattis says, I'm former chair of the Institutional Review Board, still a member of it. The example I wanted to cite for you would be from the Department of Pathology that have thousands of specimens that have been the result of surgery or pathological examinations. Those specimens have come in with a pro forma consent that they're going to do some testing and may also be used for other research. A lot of that research has been done anonymously. However, the problem is that now many studies are being done by geneticists who are looking for genetic markers that may be associated with certain kinds of cancers. For example, a researcher may want to have 20 specimens going back maybe 10, 15 years from individuals who've had breast cancer and had biopsies sent in. They get these samples coded without the identity of the patient, but the pathology department has a code book and can decode and identify who the sample is from. The geneticist may find a certain gene that appears to correlate with a good outcome if treated in a certain way. Now they want to get information on each of the samples to find out whether the patient was treated in that way and whether the outcome was good so that they can do a correlation between their genetic marker and their hypothesized outcome. They contacted the pathology department, giving the code. The pathology department finds out what the outcome was, again, without revealing the identity of the patient, passes that outcome information on to the researcher, and the correlation is made, hypothesis is tested, and either it's a supported hypothesis or not. Now, if you had to do that in a prospective way, consent each individual as you got the sample to do that sort of research, it might take 25 years to get the outcome, which can be done on these older samples that were not consented specifically to do that test. However, the identity of the individual from whom the sample was obtained is maintained. The confidentiality of that individual is maintained. An outcome that is of general benefit to many people can be done in a much shorter time. But if it was done on purely anonymous samples, there'd be no way of going back to find out what the outcome for each individual was, whether they were successfully cured of their disease. So that would be one example.
Mr. Chair, we would concur. That is exactly the kind of outcomes research that that we are concerned with.
Questions for the panel? Thank you. You have
I'll be very brief. I'm Bob Gore. My credentials are most recently chair and member of the IRB, but I've also been chair of the Department of Genetics. I'm trained as an internist. I practice medicine. I've done genetics for 30-odd years. And the problems that we are encountering in implementing some of the new technology that Brad has spoken to are clearly not simple or straightforward. And I think the most difficult part is the issue Senator Courtney has raised is, when I'm wearing my hat as a clinician and taking care of a patient, I abide by medical ethics that make me maintain confidentiality about any medical information I learn. If, however, I'm getting samples to do research, that record requires a consent that has no coercion. There's clear explanation of risks and benefits and assurances of confidentiality. And I think the fact that the medical record and the research record are completely separate and preventing that flow of information between the two is an important part of assuring confidentiality. Whatever encryption guidelines or standards are developed, I think has to recognize that it has to conform with guidelines that are also being imposed for maintaining both research records and patient record confidentiality. And I'll conclude with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Thank you for your testimony. Committee, as we've gone over this, you've had, I hope, an opportunity to look at Ted Paul's presentation. It does a very good job of explaining the history of the bill and where we are today. And puts into words the testimony we've heard. I've carried the last two bills on the Senate floor, and as I've said before, it's like studying for a final exam, and you're able to get a C+, and then the following day have trouble remembering the title of the class. But this is not any easier than the prior bills have been, and I'm sure in the next session there'll be another one to for the committee to take a look at, just because the technology is changing so quickly. The chair's preference is to adopt the gas two amendments and move it on. I know that I hope this goes to Lane Shetterly's committee, and I'm sure they'll give it careful scrutiny too. But we are in work session, so if anyone has any comments or wants anything, that'll be the time.
Mr. Chair, I'll approve the bill to the floor. I want to talk some more to the Medical Association about their concerns and try to ease my comfort level with that.
Mr. Chair, yes.
I'm going to be a no vote because this is the kind of thing I need to go in my office and shut the door and then leave and look out the window on a Sunday afternoon and then read and then look out the window and then continue to read and look out the window. I've already voiced my... I've been in surgery the last couple of years of my life. And from the moment the diagnosis was made to the very next morning I was rushed into surgery to the recovery period and the hell of the whole experience, I can honestly say that I would have signed anything at one point in that trauma and that saga in my life. I wouldn't have signed anything at one point in that saga in my life. I would have signed anything at that point. Yeah, I think I would have changed my mind maybe 3 to 4 different times. I'm very sincere about that. That's why I wanted to talk about the difference between privacy and consent. And I still have that so vivid in my mind. And I'm not right now comfortable enough that these certain people, some of whom would love to get their hands on this, and these people who are the clinicians and everything, I'm thinking about everyday patient who has got a serious medical condition or is not just walking in the hospital just for kicks or because they put an ad in the newspaper. They're in there because something seriously is wrong, and they're going to have a form put in front of them. And I just need to reach a certain comfort level before I'm going to, in law, do this kind of thing, which I think is the most personal of all things we have, our DNA. I believe it is. So I'm just not comfortable right now, and I understand all the hard work and all the rich remarks and all the records, but I just want to make that statement. I may be there in the floor, but I'm not there today.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I move the dash to amendments.
Thank you. Senator Brown moves the dash to amendments to Senate Bill 937. The discussion. Please swing out the recording and object. Are you objecting to the amendment?
I'm only objecting to the amendments.
No objection to the amendments. The motion carries. Chair would move in Senate Bill 937 as amended before due pass. Senator Courtney, would you like to be noted as objecting? Any others? Motion carries. I will attempt to carry again. And committee, as you review this, you should take a look at the existing law, because some of what we're doing here, we're clarifying existing law, and it's already allowed today, including some research. We will now go into work session on Senate Bill 461.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Member, Senate Bill 461 is the bill that you heard, well, several times now, as recently as last week. That authorizes a landowner, will authorize a landowner to submit an application for any or all uses authorized under a county's comprehensive plan. And you heard from Thousand Friends of Oregon, heard from Charlie Sundell's last week. There was some concern about the way the dash twos were drafted, and the dash twos, Mr. Honeycutt, I understand, is here today.
Right. Mr. Honeycutt, if he would come forward with. This is a bill that was given to us off the Senate floor because there was a question about, as originally drafted, if it would accomplish the intention of the sponsors. So there's been a work group that has been working on this for the last few weeks and have come up with the dash two amendments. Is that correct?
That's correct, Chair Bryant, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking on Senate Bill 461 with the dash twos. We did have a work group. We came up with amendments that I believe are reflected in the dash twos. This is the bill about ripeness. It's been in Chair Tarno's committee, or Senator Tarno's committee. I'm used to calling Chair Tarno. I spend most of my time over there and hardly any of my time over here. Ripeness, the ripeness doctrine is a doctrine that is used in Fifth Amendment takings claims to determine whether or it's used by the courts in order essentially to send back cases if the court can't determine whether or not a regulation has deprived the landowner of economically viable use of the property. In order to be entitled to compensation under the Fifth Amendment, you have to a landowner bears the burden of showing that a regulation or series of regulations substantially, either don't substantially advance a legitimate state interest or deny economically viable use of the property. It's very hard for a court to determine whether a regulation deprives a landowner of economically viable use of the property based on a single application. So typically what will happen, you will submit an application to the local government, get denied at that point if you file a claim for compensation in circuit court. The court will dismiss your claim and make you go back to the local government and submit additional applications for uses allowed in the zone and get denied for those. Your dismissal will be based, the court will dismiss your case based on ripeness. If you haven't, the problem for the landowner is by the time you've gone back and forth and back and forth to the local government and submitted multiple claims, you are usually out a substantial amount of money. So we sat down with the local government folks. The local government realized that ripeness is a problem, that you shouldn't deprive a landowner of their day, of essentially the key to the courthouse door by making them spend tens of thousands of dollars just to have their day in court. At this point, there are two, I can get a claim ripened for a client. In order to do that, there are two ways I can do that. I can submit an application, go into court, the court will send me back out to submit another application at the local government. I would submit another application at the local government, be back in court, and we'd go on and on until the court finally said, you've submitted enough applications to show me that there can't, you can't get, have an economically viable use of the property. Alternatively, I can take, in Multnomah County, for example, in the forest zone, there are 28 uses. I could take 28 applications at $1,500 a pop to Multnomah County, essentially 28 applications and a check for $42,000, give that to the Multnomah County Board of, or to the Multnomah County Planning Office, say, okay, I'm ready. You have 120 days to tell me which of these 28 application uses that I'm applying for I can make and which I can't. That we decided wasn't fair to the local governments, which I also concur with. So essentially what the Dash 2 amendments do is they allow the landowner to submit a single application and for all of the uses allowed in the zone, and they give the local government 240 days as opposed to 120 days to determine which ones of those uses you can and can't make. The nice thing about it from our perspective is instead of me paying $1,500 an application in Multnomah County for 28 different applications, $42,000 to submit all of the applications, I can submit, I can pay one application fee, which will be obviously be substantially lower than $42,000. The nice thing for the county is instead of me coming in with 28 applications and a check for $42,000 and saying you have 120 days to tell me which one of these I qualify for and which ones I don't, they get 240 days to make that determination. I, as the landowner, still bears the burden of proving that you can make those applications. The bill doesn't change any of the, doesn't shift the burden of proof. It doesn't change any of the requirements. It essentially simply makes 28 applications into one and gives the county 240 days instead of 120 to make those decisions. I don't believe I was sitting in the back with Art Schlack from the Association of Oregon Counties, and I also talked outside the hall with Phil Fell from the League of Oregon Cities. Both of those folks have given me authority to say that they are fine with the Dash 2. So the League of Cities and the AOC is fine with the Dash 2s. We think this is a nice little bill. And would certainly ask the committee to send it out with QPAS, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Why don't you stay there while we request the Dash 3 also? Well, I don't know if you've seen it from Thousand Friends. Is there someone here from Charlotte? Sundell, are you here? There's someone from Thousand Friends.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if you've seen the Dash 3.
Just briefly, Mr. Chairman.
These are hot off the press this afternoon. Could you identify yourself and then tell us what the distinction is between the twos and the threes?
Chairman Bryant and members of the committee, my name is Charlie Sundells on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and I have only now just heard of these taxpayer amendments. I'm sorry. I went to the committee office earlier to get what I understood to be the most recent amendments, and they were the Dash 2s.
Council has informed us that we're drafting Dash 3s for 1,000 Friends and asked us to wait until 3:30 or so to even hear the bill because they wouldn't be prepared until that time. Is that not correct?
Wait, the Dash 3s aren't yours?
Oh, no, they're not from us. No.
Okay. Well, that answers my question.
Okay, someone else is sitting in there?
Does anyone else have the Dash 3s prepared? The mystery drafter? All right. No. Do you have objections to the Dash 2 amendments, Charles?
No objections.
All right. Thank you.
Oh, yes. Senator Brady.
Yeah, were you part of the work group?
Yes, I was.
It was, and so you're obviously endorsing me. Who else was part of the work group?
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, we met once. There was Mike Judd from County Council from Clackamas County, Jeff Condit for the League of Oregon Cities, Mr. Swindell, myself, and Tweet, Senator Bryant, Art Schlack from the counties, and Phil Pell from the city, and Chris Crane from Ledge Council.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, another question. Art, under the dash twos that you both are supporting, would a person have to submit all of the possible applications for land, or just the ones that they are interested in?
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, I believe that one of the problems with the rightness doctrine is that the courts are more than willing to tell you when something isn't right, but they're not very clear on telling you what you need to do to ripen it. I believe that with the dash twos, I believe in order to raise a taking claim and show that you've been denied economically viable use of the property, you can't just submit applications for things you want. You would be required to submit applications for all of the uses. If the local government approves some of the uses and denied others, you would still have the potential to raise a takings claim, but you would be required to show that the uses they approved are not economically viable.
Chairman?
Yes, Member.
See, on this, the fee, what would happen? Okay, normally they pay a fee, and I think you covered this in your testimony. I went over my head. How would the fee be adjusted to taking into account the fact that you're asking them to do more work?
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, the local government is allowed to charge a fee compensable with the actual cost to the local government. So I would presume we didn't set a fee in here. We don't want to set standard fees. The local governments determine what their fees are going to be. I would presume that they would raise their fee more than the fee for, the fee would be more than the fee for a single application, but obviously less than the fee for all 28 if you paid 28 separate applications. We didn't agree to a fee. State law already requires the local governments to set their fees no higher than the amount necessary to recover their costs for processing the fee.
Okay. Thank you.
Chairman Bryan, a comment if I may. First of all, in response to Senator Burdick, Thousand Friends is not supporting the bill. We're just not opposing it. That minor distinction that you hear from time to time. I'm awfully curious about these dash threes. When I spoke on this bill before, I had four questions. I hadn't had a chance to review the bill until just before the work session, and four things struck me as questionable. Three of those were simply my misunderstanding of some of the bill. The fourth one that I raised had to do with this 240-day deadline to complete the application for the local government to act on the application. And the consequences if you didn't do so would be the mandamus remedy in circuit court, which I discussed, which is if the local government has not acted on the application within 120 days under what we call the 120-day rule or a 150-day rule for counties, the applicant can go to circuit court for writ of mandamus, and the court issues a writ ordering approval of the application, not that the local government decides the decision, but that the local government approves the decision. I recommended that it would be better not to have a time deadline in there because it's not likely to happen very often, but there's a remote possibility that if for some reason this new 240-day clock were to run, an applicant may be in a position to go to circuit court and have the court order approval of this laundry list of uses for which this bundle of quasi-judicial permit applications are being made. Therefore, I recommend that this mandamus provision be taken out of the bill. That's a little bit more of a concern for the local governments, and when I told you a moment ago that 1,000 Friends was not going to object to the bill, it was based on that. But now these dash threes, which were attributed to my organization, which I've never seen before, appear to me to be drafted to reflect that concern that I raised before, and I'd like to state for the record that that's, I don't have the statute book in front of me, but if that's the effect of the language on line 15 of dash 3, I just want to say once more for the record, I think that's a little bit better way for the bill to be drafted.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We're in work session, and the chair's preference is to move the dash 2s
The counties and the cities have agreed to it. I think it's important for the property owner to have a writ of mandamus in the event that the county or the city doesn't act promptly.
That was the issue initially in our committee, Mr. Chair. Was that opportunity for them to do that? I'll move the dash twos.
Thank you. Senator Tarnow then moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 961. Discussion? Yeah, 461 into the next bill. Objection? Senator Tarnow then moves Senate Bill 961 as amended to the floor. Do pass. Discussion?
I would like to vote no, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, please record Senator Burdick as a no vote. Motion carry. Yes, I think they did a good job of resolving it better than requiring the property owner to make 28 applications in order to make it right. And I think it's better than the initial draft of the bill. Senator Tarnow, I believe you carried the bill the first time, didn't you? I'd be happy to assist.
Just to confuse things further, Mr. Chair, Lakeside Council drafted the dash threes for what they believe was for Mr. Honeycutt and Mr. Swindell after speaking with them after the last hearing. And I just want to make sure that the committee has adopted the amendments that we think we've adopted. And so.
Two. All right. They'll have another chance if they want to reconsider on the House side. We will now go into work session on Senate Bill 691. And you have in front of you dash one amendments which replace the bill. And since we first heard this bill, we've been in discussion with the Attorney General's office, and we haven't reached agreement yet, but we're doing better.
961, Mr. Chairman.
961. So, Anne, if you describe what the actual amendments do.
The dash one amendments completely replace the original bill, and they limit the award of attorney's fees. They require the award of attorney's fees, but limit that award to cases in which the public body is the plaintiff or petitioner who brings an action against someone who's not a public body, and they lose it to the trial level. They then appeal that determination and lose again on appeal. And the bill would require the award of attorney's fees after the exhaustion of all appeals, so after basically the final judgment has been entered in the case. There are specific exemptions that are clarified or that are specified in the bill, and that is specific actions that are actually exempted for which the attorney fee award would not be required. For example, child support enforcement determinations, termination of parental rights, mandamus actions based on contract, because typically the contracts will specify themselves when and if attorney fees will be awarded, condemnation proceedings, and a violation of Oregon's election laws.
Thank you. And to let you know, we're as Ann said, it doesn't include criminal matters. It doesn't include administrative.
It's all civil.
It's all civil. We also intend to exempt the mandamus procedures and the condemnation, which also already has a specific attorney fees provision, and we'll continue our negotiations with the Attorney General's office on this. Other discussions are whether or not to put a cap on it equal to the tort claims limit for personal property damage, which is $15,000. The basis of it is, though, that for you to recover attorney fees from the state in a non-criminal or non-administrative procedure, the state would have to lose twice, once at the trial level and once at the appellate level. So that's a substantial change from the way the bill was initially drafted.
Okay, so just so I understand, they have to lose at both levels before fees can
right.
Be. Okay. And you would have brought the case.
Right, they had to be the plaintiff in the first place. It's not them being sued. So it would have a limited effect, but I think an important one. So what I would prefer to do is adopt the dash one, and I may need a courtesy vote to do this, and the negotiations will continue. Max Williams from the House Civil Judiciary has been involved in the discussions, and they'll continue. So the chair then would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 961. Discussion? Objection? Chair then would move Senate Bill 961 to the floor. Do pass. as amended. Discussion? Objection?
I will cast an aye vote, but I will reserve the right to.
Appreciate that. All right, motion carries. I will carry. We will now go to work session on Senate Bill 1125. We've had a work group on this, and the dash two amendments should be in front of you. This deals with what I would consider some cleanup from the bill we passed in 1997. I have the dash twos. And I want to thank the Department of Transportation for working with me on this. They're at a disadvantage, and these amendments were just completed beforehand today, so they haven't had an opportunity to review and give me their comments. But as I assured them before the hearing, my intent is to keep control of this bill as it goes over to Lane Shetterly's committee if they have additional concerns. But Ann, why don't you briefly say what the amendments do?
Briefly? Mr. Chair and members, I'm not the expert in condemnation by any means, so if I get some of these time limits wrong or time frames wrong, I'm sure I would appreciate it if you raise your hand and well. But in any event, according to the dash 2, in a condemnation proceeding, they would require the condemner to produce all appraisals that they had with their 60-day pre-filing offer, and would require the property owner to disclose all appraisals that they obtained 60 days or more before the first date set for trial. Or, if in fact they have not disclosed an appraisal that they obtained 60 days or more before trial, they'd be barred from actually utilizing or relying on that appraisal at trial. They specify that no appraisal would be required if the just compensation due for the property is less than $25,000. Currently, that limit is set at $20,000. It would increase the non-binding arbitration limit to claims exceeding $30,000, but not less than $60,000. And currently, those limits are $20,000 and $50,000. And in the event that the condemner and the property owner are unable to reach agreement and they actually do proceed to trial, the amendments would require the parties to exchange any subsequent appraisals that they received or that they obtained closer to the trial date, as determined by an agreement that they may reach amongst themselves, between themselves, or as ordered by the court. Perhaps
I think that covers it. So the idea is no trials by surprise. If you have appraisals that you intend to use, that you disclose them to both sides. And Al, I appreciate your comments to this particular draft of the dash 2.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Al Leitner, Department of Transportation. The amendments as drafted are fairly accurate. There is still a little bit of inconsistency in some of the 30-60-day relationships, but I think that's something that can easily be ironed out. I think that was just in the rush to try to get these done. But I think the major features are in place that will work.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you for your help on this. And if those other matters, if you could mark them up and we'll get them to Ann and take care of them on the outside. With that, then, the chair would move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1125. Discussion? Objection. The chair then would move Senate Bill 1125 to the floor to pass. Discussion? Objection. So ordered. All carried. We'll now have a work session on Senate Bill 1205. And this is one, if you recall, we had a three-hour hearing in the evening, and presentations from both the proponents and the opponents, and the proponents primarily being small and large business dealing with insurance claims for hazardous waste. The opponents of the legislation were insurance companies,
And after that, there were some questions that were raised, and John DiLorenzo, on behalf of proponents, provided information to myself and counsel, and also I enlisted Max Williams to assist me on this. And then you also have information that was provided by counsel for the insurance companies. And so that is now before you. And then today there's a letter from Lane Powell, Spears and Berkey, which you each have. They have been retained by Lloyd's of London, which is the principal excess carrier. And so they have given you a letter in opposition to Senate Bill 1205. The issues that are before us are in the dash two amendments. There were one some typographical errors, and then the initial bill referenced claims by third parties, and I deleted that. If you recall, that was something the proponents wanted, and the insurance company objected to it because it was a little bit too nebulous. When a neighbor might or may not make a claim. In this situation, if it's a claim, it probably should be an actual lawsuit rather than just a letter or a demand. And so the reference to third parties has been removed. The bill does provide, though, that in this situation, if you enter into a consent order with the DEC or the EPA or have a voluntary cleanup, that would be a triggering event under and entitled you to make a claim under the policy. These amendments do not change the original part of the bill that says if your contracts, insurance contracts, provide otherwise, that this bill will not replace any language that's in the bill. This is important because it was raised by the insurance companies, the fact that it's unconstitutional to interfere with contracts. And so I have that researched by legislative counsel, and their review indicated that the bill would not infringe on someone's contract. There is changes dealing with providing in the notice of claim relevant correspondence. That has been received by the DEQ or the EPA. And if you recall, one of the attorneys representing businesses making claims said that sometimes, firmly under Oregon law, if you make a claim against your insurance policy and you prevail, you're entitled to recover your attorney's fees and costs. And that, I believe, is by statute. If, in these matters, if the insurance policy or company offers you limits prior to the jury reaching their verdict, then they can avoid having to pay your attorney's fees and costs. And he, I think, gave two instances where there was either a settlement on the courthouse steps or just before the trial went to the jury. The disadvantage in that to the plaintiff is you've exceeded the time, the money for the attorneys and the witnesses. So what I added to the dash two was a provision that's similar to condemnation, that you have 60 days before the trial, you make the offer. And if after that the plaintiff beats the offer, they'd be entitled to recover their attorney's fees and costs. Mr. DiLorenzo suggested that be 9 months before the trial, and his argument was that you're spending a lot of money on experts and preparation. I went with the 60 days because it's true that you would be preparing for trial, but you're also discovering things, and I thought that would be a fairer compromise with the insurance company. The probably most significant thing that the bill does is it provides for if their pollution occurs in the state of Oregon, that under that the Oregon law would prevail. And currently, it's a choice of law situation.
where if the contract doesn't state which state law prevails, then there's this test that's made by the court to determine which state has the most contacts, and then that state's law prevails. I think there's enough public interest if the pollution is in Oregon, it should be Oregon law that would be the controlling factor there. The final issue dealt with horizontal versus vertical insurance excess exhaustion, and that is almost like genetic privacy, not quite as far as being able to explain. And in one of the memos that we received, well, two of them, one from the insurance company and one from Mr. DiLorenzo, it talks about horizontal and vertical exhaustion of excess. And I don't find that right now. Dated April 27th, 1999, and this refers to Section 42G of the bill. What the DAS 2s reflect is to go with what's proposed in the bill, with the understanding that if the primary insurance policy is $1 million, and for some reason you settle for $900,000 with that primary insurance policy, that for purposes of pursuing the excess and making a claim on the excess, there's an assumption that you settled for the full $1 million policy. In other words, the excess cover would not be penalized by the fact that you've settled for less than the full limits with the primary. The final thing that,
on that point, how does that come into play? Okay, you settle it for $900,000 and you've got $1 million primary policy. Why would excess insurance even be an issue there?
It would only be an issue if, let's say, you settled for $900,000, the cleanup was $2 million. So, for whatever reason, you thought it would be a good settlement at $900,000, so you settled with your primary carrier for that and pursued the excess for the other, in this case, it was $2 million, the other $1 million of coverage. You wouldn't be precluded from doing that because you didn't receive the full $1 million from your primary coverage, because you're giving the excess coverage credit for the full $1 million as you pursue the additional recovery costs.
So would you have to, if the final cleanup was $2 million, would you have to pay that remaining $100,000 out of your primary before you got into the excess, or would?
Well, I think as a practical matter, what would happen is the most you could recover in my scenario would be $1 million from your excess. You couldn't recover $1.1 million.
I see.
If you settle for less on the primary, that's an obligation, and basically it comes out of your pocket. And the theory there is it wouldn't be fair to the excess cover for you to settle on your primary policies for substantially less giving them the opportunity then to say, hey, you should settle for the full limit. So it takes that argument away by saying
it. Yeah, I guess my question was, would it be fair to go back after the excess from the primary cover? I guess once they're settled, then they're done.
Right. And it doesn't prejudice the excess in that way, because the excess carrier gets full coverage, full credit for the full limits of that policy.
So my next question is that vertical or horizontal?
I believe that's vertical.
Okay.
And then the other request that was in the initial bill was to require both joint and several liability, because the property owner has joint and several liability. The argument was the policy reads that way. I cover you for your entire loss. The bill does not no longer provide for that. That's something the court's going to have to determine. In my view of how to approach this with the dash twos, I thought that is something that the insurance company probably didn't insure for or think they were insuring for when they, as far as environmental cleanup, when they went ahead and
issued the policy. So that's what your chair has done in drafting the dash two amendments on this. I think that's what they accomplish. And with that, I'll invite Mr. DiLorenzo to come forward. And John, who would you like to come up from your group just to see if I've explained the dash two? Okay.
I can answer your question.
Well, and I'd like someone from the insurance company side too,
sure,
to see if I've mumbled through this.
Is John Powell here?
We've also received today a letter from Liberty Mutual that will include, and I've been given also a letter from American International, and we'll put that with the sign off. So, and Alliance of American Insurers from Steve Delphin. So, first of all, Mr. DiLorenzo, did I explain the dash two amendments correctly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm here on behalf of ICN Pharmaceuticals, one of the proponents of Senate Bill 1205. I believe you did. I, of course, advocated joint several liability as the rule. Once again, I'd just like to point out 1205 only applies to those instances in which policies are silent on particular terms. If an insurance company clearly writes what it means, then whether there's going to be vertical exhaustion or horizontal exhaustion or several liability or joint several liability is determined in accordance with the policy language. 1205 only applies when there are ambiguities or where there are gaps in the policy language. When there are gaps, I believe the amendments do accomplish the goal of preserving vertical exhaustion. In other words, some excess companies take the position that if you've got 5 or 6 policy years, you must first clear out every single primary policy among all of those years before any one excess carrier is exposed under the rule of vertical exhaustion. If you exhaust the primary policy for, let's say, year 1981, then the excess policy on top of year 1981 would also be responsible. I wish the bill did include joint several responsibility because that is, in fact, the rule in the state of Washington for case law, and the all sums language in the policies do provide that the insurer will pay all sums which the insured is legally obligated to pay during that policy period, and during that policy period under the law that exists today, the insured is legally obligated to pay for 100% of the whole cleanup. But I understand the forces at work here, and I am prepared to accept the chair's Solomonic division here. So, but I think Senator Bryant has explained the amendments. I think all in all, this is excellent public policy. It assures that people who otherwise have pollution coverage are not going to be discouraged from cooperating with the regulators in working towards a proactive solution to cleanups. It avoids a situation where insureds are refraining from cooperating with the regulators for fear of losing their insurance coverage. And so all in all, I think it's an excellent piece of legislation. And I thank you for the opportunity to comment.
And for the committee and the witnesses' benefits, there are some issues that we will continue to work on. For instance, what cost should be recoverable and a few other issues. I promise those who have submitted new legal briefs to me today that I will read those, and Representative Williams and I, if the bill goes forward, will continue to be in discussion. So, John or Fred, would you like to add anything today?
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Powell, representing North Pacific Insurance Companies and State Farm Insurance Companies. And I think in terms of the specific amendments that are found in the Dash 2 amendments, that your explanation of those particular areas are sufficient. The issue at hand in terms of the point that Mr. DiLorenzo made about whether or not a policy is silent on these areas. As the committee understands, this legislation is retroactive, which means that the insurers have no opportunity to fill in those gaps, or they do not have the opportunity to make the policy speak to provisions of first-party coverage, such as an insured actually including their own property, which is a little different than commercial liability. General liability was first created for. So in that respect, it makes the provisions left in the bill, and obviously we appreciate the consideration of the chair with in regards to joint and several liability, but notwithstanding that, it still makes the provision of this bill written specifically to go back in time and to capture dollars that the courts have held were not due in these particular claims. And I would simply close with having you look at the amendments on page 2 of the Dash 2, and I would respectfully submit legislation needing this kind of language indeed does point to the retroactive nature of it, even to facts that have already been found by a jury, if you look at lines 25 through 28. Thank you.
Thank you. Fred. I am Fred Venata, appearing before you on behalf of Liberty Companies and AIG, who are major players in this field. They are both gravely concerned about this language, and both of them in their letters suggest that that they believe this will affect their future writing of commercial general liability insurance in this state. It is one thing to even to look ahead, but for this legislation and this legislative body to look back and say that and change the rules so the insured can collect some more from the insurance company, but not also at the same time allow the insurance company to collect some more from the insured, is a pretty one-sided piece of legislation. And I think that policy is one that should be weighed very carefully because its ramifications are potentially very significant.
Thank you. Questions for the
panel? Mr. Chairman?
Yes, every.
Why would it discourage them from writing new policies? Why would the retroactive provisions discourage them from writing new policies?
Some of it, if I understand it correctly, you may want to.
Maybe I can answer that, Mr. Chairman. Again, John Powell of CPU, North Pacific, and State Farm Insurance Company. Mr. Chairman and Senator Burdick, I think that the major point to be made about future policies is, in fact, the change found in this bill will, in fact, write those future policies. That is, the consumer will not have available to them a policy format that is more of a general open-ended coverage, but these specific rules of construction are going to have to be addressed in each policy. So, in effect, what you're doing here is writing insurance policies.
Chairman?
Yes, sir.
If that's the problem, couldn't you just write? I guess I don't understand what's lost here. I mean, you would write in what you're not covering. I mean, this basically covers what you're silent on. So what you're saying is you can't be silent on things anymore. You have to specify. I still don't see the problem with that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the example of which state law applies, for example, has been discussed before the committee in terms of why multiple state companies may not want it specified in the contract. Under this legislation, you're probably writing basically the law, even though it's indirectly, that it will be in the contract. So that, I think, is the limitation that this legislation places on future coverages. In addition to that, just the risk of pollution liability, the risk itself that a gas station may have to purchase then, will have to be written along these lines and very specifically to each of these issues. So some people are going to have to buy this, and again, with these rules of construction, it would likely very much increase the cost of that product.
Thank you.
I'm coming.
Yes.
The dilemma is caused. I'm a quorum in the Rules Committee, and so they've called me to go down there.
Pardon?
I've been summoned. We have, I will go to Rules, continue, and probably want to ask you questions. Hold this one in days until I return, but we have three house bills. We could probably get through, and I'll be back.
Mr. Chairman, could I just direct a brief rebuttal to those 2 points? I would just say that with respect to, first of all, the future policy situation, because we have heard those claims that insurers will refuse to write future policies if this legislation passes. Senator Burdick is absolutely correct. The way an insurer gets around any rule that an insurer finds objectionable in Senate Bill 1205 is to clearly specify what the rule is in the new policy. This is for new policies that are written. So, for instance, if an excess insurer does not want to be responsible until such time as all of the primary insurers have paid, they merely need to say that in the new policies. With respect to the old policies that are already written, these are rules of construction. And with respect to cost, every single one of these insurers are almost uniformly reinsured for exposures normally over $600,000 to $10 million. So first of all, to the extent that any Oregon insurers would ever be responsible, more so than they would be under current law, those exposures are reinsured. But secondly, all this bill does is it only addresses situations where pollution coverage is there. All it says is, unless it's specified, an insurer cannot avoid pollution coverage, which is already there because the insured is cooperating with the DEQ, or because there hasn't been a suit yet, but the DEQ has issued an administrative order. And then it has a number of rules of construction which apply where these policies are silent. Now, sure, some insurers may not have anticipated every single situation, but during the testimony, we adduced a speech by the person who wrote the CGL policy nationally, who was very aware that pollution was an issue. And I think it doesn't take in the insurance business a rocket scientist to figure out that there may be other policies, and so policies should deal with other coverages. To the extent that those sections are silent, they are many times purposely silent. Well, if an insurer wants to be purposely silent, then an insurer knows what the rules will be in order.
John, can I ask you a question about the policies that are out there now? How can they be terminated?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, do you mean a policy that someone has currently paid a premium for and the coverage is actually engaged today, like your homeowner's policy that you're currently covering? How can that be canceled? Well, there is normally in an insurance policy a cancellation clause. Specific to this question on general liability, probably Tom Gordon would be the best person to answer the question who's in the room, who was the witness that was here during the hearing. Normally there is a cancellation clause which lists the reasons for termination of that particular policy. In this case, there are legal arguments that under the with the passage of this bill, there may be a legal argument for an insurer to terminate a policy. Again, due to the retroactive nature of the provisions.
Okay. Tom, did you want to add something to that?
I think Mr. Powell was right. You can't just unilaterally cancel midterm, either without a statutory provisions have to be followed. So the carrier can't just walk out on its obligations.
What is midterm?
Well, if the policy is for a one-year period, then that's what it's for, is for a one-year period.
And are these policies for 1 year period?
Pardon me?
Are these policies issued for?
It varied. Back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it was not uncommon to have policies that went for a three-year period. Today, most of them are annual.
So, in effect, if this legislation is become law and an insurance company is being impacted the way you say, they could simply just not renew after 1 year. Is that right? So they get a hand. I mean, what you just said is a natural renewal period that comes up every year. Is that correct? So both the insured and insurer.
Right. Yeah, and to follow up on your prior question, there would be one of only two things they could do. They could wait until the period was up, and then they could leave the market. So that would be their only two options. But they couldn't walk away from their existing policies, and they certainly couldn't walk away from their prior policies.
No, but my point is, after 1 year, if they don't want to renew the policy, what you're telling me, they don't have to renew the policy.
Except the way this bill is written, the coverage doesn't cease at that point because it's written on what's referred to as an occurrence basis. And so that anything that was ongoing during that 1 year...
What do you mean by ongoing?
Well, in the pollution context, what often happens is the pollution is ongoing during the year but doesn't get discovered until a later period. Follow me? So if the tanks are leaking in 1998 and the insurer issues the policy in 1998, it could cancel and leave the market in 1999, but it would still be responsible under this current form of this bill, as I understand it, jointly and severally for all pollution, whether it occurred in 1995, 6, 7, 8, 9, or into the year 2000. Because the way this bill is written, the policyholder has no obligation to pay, and any insurer has a complete obligation up to its limits.
We are disagreeing here.
Yeah.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Senator, or Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I don't believe that insurers have tail liability because of this bill. Insurers have tail liability because of the way the insurance policies are written. And by tail liability, I mean that policies, even though their terms have come to an end, are still potentially on the hook for occurrences that happen during those periods of time. This bill, whether this bill passes or not, it will not change the fact that there are old policies which are no longer currently in force that still give insurance companies exposure for environmental liability. And I think Mr. Gordon agrees on that. So it is not, this bill doesn't change that fact. There's still those exposures. This bill has to do with whether insurers can avail themselves of a number of defenses.
Exactly, and that changes the playing field for those policies that are currently in effect, whether they walk away next year from the market or not. And if they choose to stay in the market, and what I heard when I walked in the room was dealing with specifically with, well, they can change it and put in absolute pollution exclusions or other kinds of exclusions that would limit or eliminate their risk. The problem with that is that in virtually, well, not all, but in many, many cases, when the complaint first comes into an insurance company, it is not precisely clear what the underlying facts are. And to protect the public, there are now rules that are the courts have imposed, which say that you shall defend those cases until such time as it does become clear. So that's the protection to the policyholder, that if you get a complaint that isn't quite sure whether it's absolutely excluded or not, then you've got to defend that. So this, under the guise of defense costs, would impact all future policies where it wasn't absolutely crystal clear that it was excluded. And I can tell you that's probably 75% of the cases.
So no matter what you did to rewrite your policies going forward, if you stayed in this market, you would have the transaction costs to defend these environmental cases. The greatest part of these environmental cases, the biggest single expense, is defense costs. So an insurer is going to look at this as a truly unstable market, and they're going to say, I can't afford those defense costs. I can't afford to be in this market, no matter how clear I make my policy, because I won't know in each individual case when I get the facts whether it's covered or not for a while. Particularly true if the policyholder gets to control those facts. And the way this thing is set up, all they got to do is send you a summary, and you can't go behind that summary. So if that hasn't changed, then it's equally a problem.
Okay, further questions?
Could you just clarify the, when you say the contract is silent or is unclear, is there a difference between silent and unclear, or how does that affect
us? Currently, there are rules of construction, true rules of construction the Supreme Court has given us in a case called Hoffman, Hoffman Construction Company. And what it says is if the policy is not clear on its face and it is equal, is capable of equal interpretation from several perspectives, the purpose of the court is to try to truly figure out the intent. It isn't to just unilaterally decide that one party loses or one party wins. It's to truly figure out what the parties intended. The unique part of insurance contracts is there is no quote-unquote mutual intent. And I don't know if that part's still in the bill or not, but I think as we spoke last time, the way insurance works is it only operates based upon the law of large numbers. In other words, you and I couldn't withstand a devastating loss. The only way we can do that is to spread the risk amongst a large population of people so that if it happens to one of us, all of us share. The only way that works is if you understand the risk going in. If you change the risk after the fact, the law of large numbers simply doesn't work. So the way that happens in this market and in this country is that the policies are uniform by necessity. There is no mutual intent. They come to the regulators, the insurance commissioner in this state, and they say, here is the policy that was drafted by this organization, usually called Insurance Services Organization, which is a national organization. Here are the uniform terms and conditions of that. And the insurance commissioner says, we approve. That's the process. So you have the fixed risk, the thing that you can shift across broad lines. But you've got to know what that risk is going in so you can charge a fair premium so that people aren't paying for something that is not part of the risk. And if you remember we talked about last time, one of the things that was excluded was pollution. The other thing that was excluded was liquor liability, so why should the grocery store pay for the tavern liability, auto, and a variety of other categories that were considered to be unique risks. And that's the thing that's difficult about this statute. It will operate every time because there is no mutual intent in an insurance policy. If that language doesn't come out, this bill will operate every time. And to the detriment of what the parties and or the insurance commissioner may have actually intended years ago. And the process has worked. The courts have actually set up the rules of construction based upon how insurance policies are drafted and based upon how they're approved, and does have true rules of construction which have literally figured out a lot of these issues. And so it seems to me that it's going back now after the fact is truly contrary to the way insurance was constructed, how it works, why it's a good social vehicle for risk shifting, and how the courts have interpreted it for decades and decades and decades. The system works.
Do you have a question?
Well, I wanted to clarify something you talked about, spending a lot of money in litigation costs, and I was recalling the former time that we had testimony on that, and did find in the record here that the RAND Corporation said that right now 44 cents of the 88 cents being spent in cleanup-related activities were due to litigation costs.
As I recall, the RAND study is now over a decade old.
That's like yesterday's newspaper. That is really old information. And I did some checking. We haven't had an opportunity to put any more in the record because there hasn't been another hearing. But I can tell you that a number of the insurance companies that I work for are spending less than 10 cents on every dollar. Some of them are spending 15 cents. But I don't know anybody that's spending those kind of dollars on insurance coverage litigation. It isn't happening today.
Well, it would be interesting to clarify that because anybody who came to testify regarding non-payment by insurance companies talked about all of the high costs, all of their high legal costs, and that most of the time and money spent have to do with insurers fighting the payment of the cleanup or fighting the fact that they were even liable to cover any of these costs.
Well, and of course, at the hearing, I think we heard from two, maybe three actual policyholders. There are thousands that make claims.
And I think we heard from an attorney who represents quite a few other policyholders, and that's all he does, is represent policyholders who, and he full-time fights insurance companies to get payment for claims, for these environmental claims.
Mr. McDermott?
Yeah.
Well, statistically, I can say that after that, I did check, and that no insurance company is spending anything remotely close to those RAND study numbers today.
I would appreciate you submitting that.
Sure.
For the record.
Sure.
For me, specifically.
Excuse me. Can I just ask the gentleman, have you guys been working together, you just went your separate ways?
Pardon me?
Well, we had that two-year hearing. If you guys are working together, you just went your separate ways since then.
Maybe I can answer that question, Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney. I think, unfortunately, given the deadlines that you have faced here on your bills, we have not been able to have the types of conversations that we ordinarily would have had. I would hope that many of those conversations would take place on the House side.
So, if I just want to ask, I'm not trying to embarrass you.
Nope.
I'm just trying to get. So you guys are not just, it's our way or no way. You just dug in and you don't talk. Or you, that's not what the insurance. I hate to refer to you as the insurance industry because you. Is that going on or not going on?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, I don't think it's fair to say we haven't talked. I think the chair outlined at the beginning how we kind of undertook the process of briefing on certain issues. And Mr. DiLorenzo produced three major briefs on some of the major topics, and Mr. Gordon basically answered those briefs. I think what Mr. DiLorenzo mentioned was that we didn't have a work group per se to try to work this out. And in fairness again to the chair and to Mr. DiLorenzo, I think we could meet until the next millennium is almost over.
Okay.
And this is so, in our view, so unprecedented that and so foreign to the nature of how you rate insurance policies that we could not agree to a retroactive provision in the bill. In insurance terms, it doesn't make sense.
Thank you, Ronnie. Did you refer to
and what I did as the chair after I got the briefs, and I've been in conversation with the parties, I didn't see much chance of using my usual approach of putting people in a work group and trying to find a compromise. On these issues, that would be not difficult, would be an understatement.
This retroactivity, you sure that's constitutionally okay?
I checked with legislative counsel, and they said this was not an infringement of the contract. But due to a request from a couple members of the committee, and since you've only received some of this new information today, I'm going to close the work session, give you a chance to read it. I'm sure that President Adams would give me another couple days to bring this back, and we will do that.
This is
a difficult issue.
Yeah,
this is great stuff for law school.
Yeah, it is.
happen.
Yeah, John, if you're missing copies, we can provide you.
Okay.
Okay? Thank you.
Okay.
Perfect. Okay. We will now, committee, we have three short bills to do, and we will call it in. We have some witnesses. We'll do House Bill 2381, invite Mike Dewey, Jeff Knapp, William Baker, Jr., and Eugene Clark, of course. And I'm sure Mr. Dewey has explained to these people that we had a Senate bill deadline, and that's why we were doing the Senate bills in work session today before we did House bills. And if he hasn't, I'm sure he will afterwards, because he's a very quality lobbyist. He doesn't want to make the Senate look bad. Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to see if I can remember what this bill does. The folks who are cable technicians, I think, are happy to go back to their job tomorrow and do their work on the poles and so forth based on the variety of issues.
They don't want to deal with it.
For the record, my name is Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I have a handout for you and some information that you can get off the Internet and so forth. This is a bill that relates to cable theft. The bill came out of the House Judiciary Civil Law Committee unanimously and passed the House unanimously, and obviously we're going to ask for your support. And we're going to try and do this as quickly as possible because I know you have some other bills. And these folks are going to show you real quickly in a few minutes why the problem is fairly prevalent in our industry. And what we're going to try and do about it with this particular bill. There are criminal penalties for cable theft already in the statutes, ORS 164. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to prosecute, and there are two reasons. One is, clearly in terms of priorities for the DA and the police, this is not a serious crime. There are much more serious crimes out there. Secondly, just the virtue of the industry in terms of the cost of the crime and so forth, it is usually a misdemeanor because of the way that you have the low threshold of trying to determine what the damages are. So we've taken a page from Colorado and California and basically are seeking a civil remedy. And Section 2 outlines the various types of cable theft and allows a cable operator to bring a civil action when the person has, and this is the key, knowingly committed cable theft with the intent to defraud a cable company. And again, Section 2 outlines the various ways that cable theft occurs, and there are a variety of ways that that happens. Also, then we get into Section 3, and this is basically, if you will, the protections before you seek the civil remedy for individuals, and it would require that certain things occur before we seek the civil remedy. For example, in Section 3, Sub 5, one of the areas is just basically hooking up to the cable illegally as opposed to converting the black box, if you will. And if we were to seek a civil remedy and damages under this bill, if somebody did that, we would first disconnect them. We'd send them a notice that we believe they were stealing our service. And if they did it again, then we would have an opportunity to go to court and probably prevail under a presumption. The cable industry did a survey a couple years ago and found that cable theft exceeded $6 billion a year. 11% of the homes passed had illegal connections, and 9% had unauthorized service for basically HBO, that sort of thing. Paragon is here with me, Mr. Knapp. And he'll talk about their situation and what they're doing and what the numbers are. Mr. Morton from Ben Cable is here. Their survey was in the area of 5% of unauthorized service use. And it's going to get worse for us, unfortunately, because of the digital age.
where there are many more services that individuals can take. So the number is going to go up in terms of the theft of cable service. There's not much we can do about that. We believe that if somebody has a black box that's been maybe converted, it's been opened up and a chip put in, and these guys will show you how that works in just a minute. On average, they'll last for about 18 months. You can buy them in the black market, for example, and the losses would average about $1,700 over that period of time. And that's just in terms of how many movies somebody might buy that would basically be free. This is a situation that, unfortunately, the average person says, you know, cable theft is not that big a deal. My neighbor does it. Other people do it. You're not going to be found out. You're not going to be prosecuted, and that's why we are going after this particular bill. You might be surprised to know that in terms of the frequencies that we operate in, the radio frequencies, they're very close to the aeronautical frequencies. So we have responsibility to make sure that there's no signal leakage. And when somebody breaks into our system, undoubtedly there will be signal leakage. And we're responsible for that. And again, it can compromise the aeronautical folks. And so that's something that we're very concerned about. That's why we have asked for this bill also. Obviously, if we lose revenues, cities lose revenues because we pay 5% of our gross to cities, and that goes primarily into the general fund. In Portland, it's 8.64%. They think they lose about $3 million a year, so that's an awful lot of money. And this gives us then a kind of a statewide standard. Now, frankly, we are not going to use this remedy very often. What we are going to do is publicize to the folks, and we have the medium to do that, that we have another bullet in our gun, so to speak, and we think it's important that people understand that if we go through the process and we seek the civil remedy, that we probably will prevail, and people ought not steal the service. So we hope, again, that you'll look favorably on this bill, and I'll ask Mr. Knapp to comment a little bit about their situation, and these folks will very quickly tell you or show you why it's readily or easily available to do some of the things that happen.
Before Mr. Knapp speaks, I need to declare a potential conflict of interest in that. I represent Bend Cable in Bend, Oregon, and this would probably be a specific enough bill to require a disclosure. So, Mr. Knapp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Knapp, and I'm Public Affairs Specialist for Paragon Cable. We serve about 128,000 customers east of the Willamette River in Portland and Multnomah County, parts of Clackamas County. Throughout the history of cable television, there have been the backyard thieves who have hooked up illegally to cable taps, and it has grown. It's been one of those things that there has been very little recourse over time to address. They make up approximately 5% of the homes passed by cable television in our area, and that represents 6,200 illegal viewers in your casual backyard hookups. At an average of about $40 per customer per month, the illegal hookups alone represent revenues loss of over $3 million each year. New technology is making it more of a prize, more sophistication, makes it actually a little bit easier now for cable thieves. There are websites available where you can access. One is blatantly called www.freecable.com. And there are also many publications and services where people can purchase illegal chips. This type of theft is estimated from our actual field work, and we do track this, to be upwards of 12% or nearly 15,000 customers in our system alone. And if these customers just watch one premium channel, one pay-per-view movie, one sporting event each month, the theft represents lost revenues of another $7.2 million annually. And so you combine the backyard theft, our company alone loses over $10 million in revenues each year. We represent 17% of the cable customers statewide. And so this translates statewide to over $50 million of lost revenues to Oregon cable companies. Our cities are losing over $2.6 million in revenues each year. And I do have a couple of people with me that can show you basically how this is being done. Kelly Farr is our converter control supervisor, and Skip Baker is our field tap auditor. They disconnected 250 illegal cable television converter boxes last year and over 500 electronically altered converters last year and already this year. And we're just in early May. They've already collected over 300 illegal converter boxes like the ones that they're going to show you. And so, Kelly and Skip, would you like to demonstrate how this is done?
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman. Can we approach?
Sure. Now come on up here.
This is the inside of one of our converter boxes, and this happens to be the illegal chip that people are so easy to come across. They can purchase these from out of popular mechanics magazines, through the internet, through the nickel ads, and
we've counted the chips, by the way, for the running
game. What that does is it changes the terminal address of the converter box and allows them a wide open space, then allowing them to reach the back channel. This one here happens to be one that they also make in purchase from catalog or internet. And there's also warning labels that these companies would put on there, though consumers don't give us a call saying that they've purchased one. They do put warning labels to say, give us a call that they're going to use it, but we don't hear from these people anyway. And then just a nickel ad, people advertise on the front page and throughout how they get people get deals via the boxes. So it's ongoing.
And they do the installation for them also?
Yes. People will buy, come to your home and then they'll buy the box maybe you have.
So how do you capture them if this happens?
Yeah.
What we do is we have a non-response list. If we offer people that snitch off their neighbors, friends, we go out there like this, dressed like this. We just have to see our equipment. And then after they loosen up, and we just have to see the equipment, they allow us in, and we find our boxes in this condition, we take them, write them a receipt, and try to keep them as a customer.
Do they usually confess at that point?
Yes. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I would add that obviously passage of this bill is not going to completely deter people. Financial motives are involved. But we do think it is a step in the right direction because clearly for us, and I didn't say this, it's in my written testimony, Dale Penn, the Marion County DA, likes this approach because we bother them about it, and they tell us we can't do anything about it because, one, the value is too low, and therefore it's not a serious crime, and clearly it's not a serious crime anyway. So we think this gives us another tool for us to use, and as I said earlier, because of our medium, we will plan to put together kind of a statewide campaign, media campaign, to let people know that, and they're going to be watching cable, so that's kind of a great thing about it. If they're watching broadcast, it doesn't make any difference. So we are going to do that, and we think it's a step in the right direction. The folks in Colorado passed a bill 2 years ago, and they say it seems to be working in terms of fewer people because of the possibility that we have now a tool that we didn't have before.
Well, if you could let us know how it works, well, this might work on some other types of stuff too. Questions for the panel?
You said, Mark, that there was a reduction in the number. Do you have any idea of how that saved the cable company lost?
Mr. Chair and Senator Q-Tub, the folks in Colorado also ran a media campaign, and I talked to the folks in Denver, and I had testimony that was sent to me from the TCI system in Denver, and it was pretty comparable to Portland in terms of the percentages. and they've noted that their numbers appear to be going down as they do the field audits. When we had a work session in the Judiciary Committee on this bill, one of the individuals wanted to make sure that these people wouldn't lose their job because there would be no theft, and we assured them there'd still be some out there. But we think it's going to make it, we believe it's going to be an impact. The other opportunity we have is for those that have an illegal hookup, the coax that we don't know about to the back of the television, for example, they're not going to get a bill from us. But what we're seeing is the conversion of these boxes. And they do get a bill from us each month, and we're going to be putting flyers in and so forth. And unfortunately, there are ways to, we didn't get into this, bullets that can be used to, if we try and you might talk about that, but from time to time we'll zap out somebody who we think has HBO or Showtime illegally, but it doesn't, because of the technology, sometimes allow us to do that. So there are a lot of different ways, and we're working at trying to be as good as we can about creating the technology to beat the folks. So I'll tell you a story just to and finish here, if there are no more questions. When HBO started to de-scramble their signal, in other words, when it came from the satellite down, there was basically a code both on the video side and the audio side. And the code on the next day, the code was broken, and it was a military code made up of 150 different digits, if you will, that changed every second. And you can imagine how difficult you might think for that code to change or to be broken. But evidently, the next day, there was people that were selling stuff so you could at least get the audio portion, and a week later, the video portion of it. So people are pretty good at doing those kinds of things and figuring out the randomness of those codes. And all it takes is a little chip to put in to that guy.
Well, thanks for your testimony.
If you're able to file an injunctive relief or file for damages in circuit court, does that happen very often? These people just sort of cough up, or is this going to cause a huge influx of criminal cases, or I don't know, criminal cases or civil claims? How does that
happen? Well, actually, in talking to the folks in the other states, we think that's the deterrent. What we want to do is keep these individuals as customers, or make them customers. We do not want to lose them, because, as you know, we talked about the business in your committee, that there is competition
So then you give them notice, you file them a use of citation, and you say, yeah, we're going to go to court.
We will basically, based upon the provisions of the bill, and if we believe they have knowingly committed cable theft, and we have to do certain things before we can seek the remedy and go to court, there's no question that they're going to basically say, we would like to make you a customer of ours. And we'd like to settle this, because we have a remedy you don't know about, or if you might know about, and that is, we can go to court, and we probably will prevail. And we can collect damages from you, and we can collect attorney fees. And based upon what's occurred in other states, that is not happening, because, one, once you do that, you're never going to have them as a customer again. They're going to hate you. So this is the deterrent, or the tool that we need, we think, to get to help solve this problem.
Thank you for your testimony. We have one other witness, Gary Bauer, who has 30 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with the Oregon Telecommunications Association. We're primarily a telephone trade association, but half of the small telephone companies in the state also provide cable service. They serve very small rural communities. And just wanted to share with you, this is not a problem that's only happens in large communities, large cities. The area of Beaver Creek, which doesn't really have an incorporated community, recently did a survey of their network, found about 30-some people. Actually found it was somebody in the community that was actually distributing these to their friends and neighbors. So it's something that happens around the state. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2381 open work session.
and move the bill to the floor of the group pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney, move House Bill 2381, the floor do pass. Discussion? Objection? Order to carry, please.
Okay.
All right.
That's the question.
Next, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2720. Warren Garris. And Warren, being the perceptive guy you are, you know we're tired and drawn. And this is a boring bill.
No, this is probate.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Warren Darris. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland with a practice that emphasizes estate planning and probate. I also have the unique perspective for the last several years of being on a list that the probate judge in Multnomah County and to some degree Washington and Clackamas counties use to deal with problem probates. So that means I get to try to deal with people to steal money out of probate, which is a recurring problem. The area of probate that this bill addresses, conservatorships and decedent estates, addresses one obvious problem, and that problem is unattended wealth. Wealth is unattended because the owner dies or because the owner becomes disabled. The solution for the probate court is to put somebody in charge of that wealth, called a personal representative or a conservator, with a large body of rules called fiduciary standards governing them and very little supervision except for one thing. And that one thing is that they are required to file accounts with the court containing both financial disclosure and text on what they have been doing to give the court an opportunity to review that. The difficulty we have in Oregon is that the standards for accountings are virtually non-existent. There seem to be as many formats for accountings as there are attorneys in the estate for practice probate. There are 2,000 members, by the way, of the estate planning and administration section of the Oregon State Bar.
Great testimony. Would you be offended if I cut you off and we...
Not at all.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing then on House Bill 2720 and Senator...
I move House Bill 2720 to the floor, do pass recommendation. I'm the one to cut you off. I'm sorry. I guess so. Let's just do it.
All right. That's the motion. Discussion. Objections are ordered. I'll carry your bill since I've carried your other bills. And I want to say hi to your daughter. I hope she found the afternoon to be interesting.
Thank you.
Okay. We will now open the public hearing on 2180. And this is an easy one, too. Langdon Marsh. Well, let's introduce Lori and Langdon and Kathy.
Yeah, her boss is
there. They've been here for 3 hours.
We need to talk.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Members of the committee, I'm Langdon Marsh, DEQ Director. This is a very simple bill, I hope, that passed the House Judiciary unanimously and the House unanimously. And basically what it is to make sure that we can preserve delegation of our portion of our clean air program from the federal government. Title V in particular is the permitting program. And due to various legal situations that are outlined in the testimony, it requires the passage of a bill to restore representational standing in order for us to maintain that delegated status. Oregon Supreme Court case limited representational standing, that is, the standing of an organization to challenge a decision of the Department of Environmental Quality on the basis of being an organization as opposed to the individual member of an organization or an individual citizen. We'd like to restore that organizational standing in order for us to maintain delegation of our clean air program from the federal government. It's just worth pointing out that if we don't do this and the federal government does take over permitting responsibilities in the state of Oregon, which many people oppose, that these cases would be dealt with in federal court, which does allow for organizational or representational standing. The bill is supported by AOI. They've submitted a letter and Northwest Pulp and Paper, and APA, and turn it over to Kathy Bennett.
All right. Lori and Kathy, we have your letter. Is there anything you'd like to add before we pass this bill out?
Chair Brian, Catherine Vanat, the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association, we support this bill.
Thank you.
We've got to
go. We've got to close the public hearing and open the first section on 21.
This little issue arose in House Bill, I believe, 2948 last session, which was the APA bill that the governor vetoed, and I certainly would support representational standing on a broader issue allowing all sorts of groups to move forward, but as it is, I'll support the bill.
Thank you.
Narrow form.
I move House Bill 2180 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation, please.
Thank you. Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Cordy. We have
I hope I can get it in, Mr. Cordy.
Here, have one bill left. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, can I vote on two bills?
Yes.
Senate Bill 915, I would vote aye. It doesn't change the outcome. And Senate Bill 961, I vote no.
Thank you.
Mr.
Doesn't change the outcome.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I would, this is Tucker.
Without objection, order.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to vote aye on Senate Bill 915 and aye on House Bill 2381, and if you'd like me to volunteer to carry it, I would do that, too. It won't change the outcome.
Okay, they won't change that without objection, order. Thank you, committee. Sorry we ran later, and I thought genetic privacy and the other took a little longer.
You're carrying that bill, aren't you?
Yeah.